What we're going to learn today, it's going to be a perspective, Hasidic perspective on faith, emunah in Hebrew, emunah in Hebrew. We're going to learn what the texts say about the difference between emunah, faith, in a Jew and a non-Jew. And I would like to say, even though I didn't see all of the details that I'm going to share written down, but I would like to say that certain levels apply that apparently don't apply, certain levels apply also to non-Jews. And this is through actually what we're going to do, about learning, about understanding, and trying to grow on our faith. So let's go, let's move on. First of all, very short, we all know there's a general message of Judaism for the non-Jews. Those are the mitzvahs, of course, things you cannot do. I don't do idolatry, don't do blasphemies, don't go do these things. You're not supposed to be doing them. Forbidden relationships, stealing, killing, and eating part of a living animal, whatever. And don't do injustice. Don't be unjust, so go do justice. Those are the seven common messages. And it is known, I took care to put the sources, because it's interesting for you also to go and look for them and learn them and so on. So it's not just seven messages, quote unquote, simple things. Rather, they have many, many, many derivatives, many, lots of them, more than you can actually think of, as we're going to learn in a minute, about the specific thing of idolatry. So today, we're going to learn specifically about faith. And the truth is that faith, to have faith in God, whatever that means, that we're going to discuss in a minute, to have faith in God is actually a derivative of idolatry. Since there's a prohibition of not doing idolatry, so don't do idolatry, immediately the positive counterpart, so to speak, is believe in God, have faith in God. There is such a thing as an entity called God, as we're going to discuss in a minute. So faith, it's something that derives from the prohibition of idolatry, together with, today we're not going to discuss this, but trusting God. It's not just faith, whatever that means, that we're going to answer in a minute, discuss in a minute what means, trusting God and prayer. In the same place that actually the Rebbe, this is the source, the Rebbe says that we have to have, the non-Jews have to have faith in God. In the same place it says, this includes trusting God, and this includes praying to God, whatever that means. Okay, in order to see that there are so many derivatives of, in this particular case, idolatry, for instance, and I brought all the sources, you can go look them, anger. To be angry at something, it's also a form of idolatry. You have to be very careful. That doesn't mean, please do not misunderstand, that doesn't mean that when a person, let's take a non-Jew, gets angry, or let's take a Jew also, gets angry, because the punishment for idolatry for a non-Jew is to be killed, and for a Jew is also to be killed. And just as today, we don't have this punishment for Jews, we also don't have this punishment for non-Jews. Same rules, so to speak, apply. And if somebody is going to say, so why do we care what the punishment was, if anyway it doesn't apply today? The answer is to understand how terrible this is. The hardest the punishment, the hardest the transgression is. And just as a side note, the punishment for a Jew for committing idolatry was to be stoned. That actually it wasn't they didn't stand in one place and everybody is throwing stones at them. No. It wasn't like that. It's discussed in the Talmud, it's discussed in Rambam, in the laws of Sanhedrin, of judges and so on, how it really was. But the point is that there was a stone, in Hebrew it's called skila. There was a stone, whatever, involved in the whole thing. And actually it means that spiritually speaking, the heart becomes hard as stone. So this punishment of being stoned to death, whatever it was, actually applies. Oh yes, it does apply, but not in a physical and real, quote-unquote, matter way, rather in a spiritual way. Your heart becomes hard as stone, or your brain, which I don't know what's worse. I don't know. We're not going to discuss this. But whatever the case, the punishments actually apply. So getting angry at something, anything, it's a form of idolatry. Not giving tzedakah, not wanting to give tzedakah. That doesn't mean that you found a poor person, asked you for money, you didn't have anything in your pockets, now you're doing idolatry. No. Wait a second. It means you don't want to give tzedakah. That's what it means. Not that you don't have. If you don't have, you don't have. What do you want? If you don't want to give, so that's a way of idolatry also. Hatred, feeling hatred for other people, that's a way of idolatry. Feeling yourself proud. I'm the best rabbi in the world. You should have more respect when talking to me. Okay, wait a second. Who do you think you are? That's a form of idolatry. Talking bad tongue, it's also a form of idolatry. So our sages even bring others, whatever. So we see that it doesn't end in the quote-unquote simple fact of raising up a brick or whatever and saying, this is my God, please God, give me money, give me help. It doesn't end there. It includes also that, but it doesn't end over there. There's a lot more to it. So today, we're going to learn one perspective. There could be others. Yes, I recognize that. We're going to learn one perspective, Hasidic perspective, on one derivative of idolatry, faith. I mean, in the positive sense. So what's faith? What does it mean? What's the definition of faith? We're going to see a few details in levels. Simple level, and a deeper level, and a deeper level, and so on. So, first of all, the most basic definition of faith is there is a creator. There is such a thing as a creator, and he directs the world, as we're going to learn later, inside a very interesting Hasidic discourse. I think you're going to like this, because it talks really directly to non-Jews. We'll see later, God willing. So there is a creator, there is a director of the world, and Avram, of whom we're going to learn later at the end of the class, God willing, he already publicized this. He already made everybody know that there's a God, and God appreciated this so much. He loved Avram so much. Why? Because nobody was talking about God. The Rambam says this in the beginning of Laws of Idolatry. Nobody was talking in the world, the whole world, about God. No such thing. And Avram came up with this, quote-unquote, this idea, and he spoke to every single person about it. And God was so happy about it. This is what the Midrash says. And it is a very interesting idea that the Rebbe brings. It is a mitzvah. For non-Jews, even though it's not written in the seven mitzvahs, wait a second, there is only seven. The rabbi is talking about more than seven. Wait a second, the list of seven is just prohibitions you're not supposed to be doing. But it does not include not even one mitzvah's assay. Go do something. It doesn't include, just talks about prohibitions. If you're going to say, wait a second, but we have to put just judges and courts of judgment and so on. No. The mitzvah is don't do, I don't know the exact words in English, you will forgive me, but don't do injustice. Don't be unjust. The mitzvah is not to do justice. The mitzvah is don't be the opposite. Don't do the opposite of justice. So it's also a negative mitzvah, so to speak. So again, the Rebbe says it's a positive mitzvah for non-Jews to learn about God, to understand as much as you can understand about God, even in a deep way, like for instance, the second part of Tanya, Shara Ichud Ve'emuna, the portal of the unity of God, the faith, what faith means. That Rebbe talks about faith also over there. And he's going to say basically the same thing. I'm going to say the same thing that he says, but whatever. So it's a mitzvah. You should learn about this. We could finish the class over here. Go learn about God. And that's what it means to have faith. But there's deeper stuff. Let's go learn. Point number one, our sages explain in the mysticism of Judaism, Kabbalah, Hasidus, I don't care what you call it. The sages explain that there are two ways God relates, so to speak, with the world. There's a way that is called in Hebrew, and actually in Aramaic, Memale Kol Almin, that God fills all the worlds. I'll explain this in a minute. And there's a way that our sages call in Aramaic, in the Zohar, it's found so many times, Soivev Kol Almin, that God transcends and goes around, is around all the worlds. These are the two ways to understand the difference between these two things. One example could be the difference between intellect in general and will. Intellect is like a very inner power in the person, that it expresses itself in the brain. With the brain, you understand things. You don't understand things with your hand. You do things with your hand. You understand with your brain. And the same thing happens with other powers of the soul and the body, the connection between the soul and the body. For instance, you see with your eyes. You smell with your nose. And you taste with your tongue or mouth, whatever. So each member of the body has a specific function, and it draws from the soul a specific power of the soul in order for that function to actually work properly. Imagine if the power of seeing was in the feet. Oops, I can't see, I'm sorry. The architecture, the physical form of the eye allows a person to see. The physical form of the feet, whatever, doesn't allow you to see, it allows you to walk. You can't walk with your eyes and so on, combining all the powers. So that means Memale Kol Almin, how God fills the world. Each creature has exactly the amount of livelihood, of power, of energy, godly energy, that needs to live, to exist, and to live and to function properly. The cat is a cat, the dog is a dog, the human is a human, and so on. The stone is a stone, whatever, so on. Now, both, I didn't expect the second one, I'm sorry. Soivev Kol Almin would be, the example to this, would be will, the power of will. That's how it's brought down in the Hasidic teachings. The power of will. The power of will is found everywhere in the body. It doesn't depend on a member. It doesn't depend on how far it is from the head. No. It's found everywhere. As soon as you will, you move your hand. As soon as you will, you walk. As soon as you will, you see, or whatever. You close your eyes or you don't close. It takes all the body at the same time. It doesn't depend on a place in the body. It doesn't depend on a member in the body. That's what it means to transcend, to go beyond, so to speak, all the body. So God gives to the world these two energies, that each one of them is found in every single creature, every single time, because that's what gives life to the whole world. Now, which one of these should we have faith on? To which idea of these two ideas applies the concept of faith? In order to understand this, so let's look at a few books, classical books of Judaism that talk about the first commandment, mitzvah, of the whole Torah. There are different opinions on this, but whatever. The Rambam, when he starts his book of laws, Mishneh Torah, he starts with the first mitzvah, and he defines the first mitzvah as knowing, I stress this word, not having faith, knowing that there's a first existence that is God and so on. He explains what God is. We're not going to learn this inside. So we see that the first mitzvah itself is not to have faith in God. No, no, no. The first mitzvah is to know that there's a God. How can you know that there's a God? Because you look around yourself, you look at the world, and you can find the wisdom of God in every single corner in the world. You can find that the whole creation, it's very ordered. Like, even if you take an atom and you look at it, and the electrons and the protons and all the parts of the world, every single thing in the world follows very defined and specific rules, and it never transgresses its own rule. It doesn't behave like crazy. And every single thing in the world has a place, has a shape, And why? Why does it exist? Sometimes we can't understand what it is. But again, as I said before, not necessarily we have to understand everything that God does. We're not God. We're just human beings. And whatever he wants us to understand, so we understand it. And whatever he doesn't think that we should understand, we we don't understand. And that's not a problem. That's not a problem at all. But the point is that, again, we don't need faith to deal with how God feels the world. In other words, that God exists. We don't need faith for that. Just open your eyes. There's a very famous phrase, could be discussed, but very famous phrase that a physical thing doesn't make itself. There's no one thing in the world, physical world that we know, that made itself. Actually, Pharaoh, he thought himself, I made myself. He used to say, the river, the Nile River is mine, and I made myself. I'm my own God. Whatever, that's what he thought. But we know that such a thing doesn't exist. And even till today, scientists could not make something out of nothing, just poop, pops up and starts being. There's no such a thing. That means that, again, if you open your eyes and you see around and you see a world, you see yourself, you came from somewhere. You didn't make yourself. Yeah, my father and my mother. Okay, where did it come from? Yeah, my grandfather and my grandfather. Start going back and back and back. At some point, it started. And not just a human being, but the whole world. At some point, you have to ask yourself, where did this come from? Interestingly, it is not a scientific question. Scientific question would be, now that we see that this thing exists, and this thing behaves in a specific way, what are the rules that actually govern the way this thing behaves? That's a scientific question. That's a good question. Like we see gravity. If something falls, why does it fall? So, okay, you can answer, because there's Earth, you know, the celestial bodies in the world and in the universe, and there's a gravity, okay? And it's different in the Moon, it's different in Mars, and so on. And then the Earth works in a very specific way with certain quote-unquote rules. That's fine, that's a scientific question. Why things fall? Why did the apple fall in the head of Newton? Okay, because there's gravity and he came up with the idea and he was a great mind, whatever. Okay, that's a scientific question. But where did the whole creation come from? That's not a scientific question, that's a religious question. Sometimes they like mix or they like touch each other, science and religion. Sometimes they don't. But in any case, according to the religious point of view, God created the whole world. Scientists just say, don't know. I don't know. And it's not a problem. For science, it's okay. It's not a scientific question, so it's okay. You can say, I don't know. Not a problem. But for religious people, we say, God created the world. And who created God? Now, you're wrong. God is not a creation. God is not something physical that falls into the category of who created him. God is beyond mind. So therefore, he was never created. And he doesn't age and so on. That's the definition of God. You can go learn the Rambam in the beginning of Mishneh Torah and you laws of fundamentals of Torah, you will see what the Rambam talks about God, what he doesn't have a body, he's one, and so on. This is basically the first mitzvah of the Torah, but it still doesn't touch the idea of faith. So that means that in the most simple, so to speak, definition of the first mitzvah of the Torah is not to have faith in God. Not at all. It's to understand that there's a God. To the point that certain authorities say that faith is not even a mitzvah. Forget it. Because it's impossible to say that faith would be a mitzvah. Doesn't make sense. Why? Because what is a mitzvah? What's a commandment? Commandment forces that there's somebody, something, whatever, that commands and says a certain thing. Go do this, don't do that, and so on. So if you accept that there are commandments, there are orders that come from God or whatever you want to call him, you're already accepting that there's a God. So it's impossible for God to come and say, have faith in me. What do you mean faith? I already accept you exist. And I'm accepting now your rules, your orders. So it doesn't make sense that one of the orders should be, don't forget I'm here. I know you're there. That's why I'm accepting your orders. Otherwise, I wouldn't accept it. Who are you? So therefore, according to certain authorities, this is the Behag, it's not known exactly who wrote this book. It's from the 1900s. It's for year 900, 800 or 900 in common era. So it's not even known who really wrote it, but it's very brought down in many, many other books. It's a holy and known book. But he writes basically, faith is not a mitzvah. It's something else. Whatever, it's not a mitzvah. Again, like the Rambam says, the mitzvah is to understand that there's a God. There's another explanation of this same idea, a little bit more subtle. This was written down by Don Itzhak Abarbanel. He lived in Spain, 1400s, 1500s. End of 1400s, 1500s, he left Spain together with all the Jews that were expelled from Spain in 1492. He writes that, yeah, there is a mitzvah of faith. Wait a second. I understand what the Rambam says. He wrote a whole book on these few chapters of the Rambam. Very interesting, difficult to read, but he wrote something interesting. What's the mitzvah of faith? To believe, and I stress the word believe, not understand, believe that this existence that we call God is the most complete existence. It's not like any other existence, like me, you, or whatever. No. God doesn't need anyone to exist. That means he's independent of everything, but everything depends on him. Everything needs him to exist. He doesn't need anything else to exist. That's already something that is not, according to the Abarbanel, into the realm of understanding. That's already faith. So we see now there's a difference between understanding and having faith. Understanding means something you can actually, with your mind, work on it, think about it, and come to an intellectual conclusion, even though sometimes you don't have like scientific proof for that. Prove me scientifically that God exists. It's impossible. Doesn't make any sense. Again, because God is a religious thing and science is not about religions. Science is about proofs, empirical proof of things, not religion. So it's like a stupid phrase. Prove me scientifically that God exists. Bye-bye. You don't understand what God is, and you don't understand what science is. No more. I don't need to talk to you anymore about this subject. You don't know what you're talking about. So that's why that's one way of understanding. Again, there are certain things we can intellectually come to the conclusion that they exist, so you don't need faith for that. And there are certain things that, intellectually speaking, don't make any sense, and that's when faith comes in. And again, according to the Behag, doesn't make any sense to talk about a mitzvah of faith. And according to the Abarbanel, yeah, it makes sense, but let's put it up, so to speak. Let's move it into a higher level, the idea of faith, a complete existence. However, Chassidus says, very nice what the Abarbanel says. It's very interesting, but that's just one level. Because actually, intellectually speaking, the only way a God could be called God is if he's a complete and absolute existence, that he doesn't depend on anything. That's also mind. That's also intellect. So faith can't be the idea that God is the most complete existence. He doesn't need anyone. Everybody needs him. That also is a rational thing. So it doesn't make any sense to call that idea faith. That's already understanding. And to be honest, as we're going to see in a minute, faith itself changes and grows. And there's a way of nurturing faith. What does that mean? The more you understand about something, the less faith you need on that something. Example, you go to a doctor and you're not a doctor. You go to a doctor and you have a problem. The doctor says, take this pill. And you see like a bluish thing, a pill. What is this pill? I don't understand. The doctor says, look, I studied medicine. Let's suppose he knows. I studied medicine and I know you have this problem and this is the pill you need to take for this problem. You could say at one very basic level, you have faith in the doctor. You don't know unless you go spend I don't know how many years learning, and then you whatever try to heal yourself from this sickness you have, or you just take the pill and that's it. The doctor knows what he's doing. He knows what he's talking about. So at a very, very basic level, you can say you have faith in the doctor. But wait a second. If you go learn medicine and spend all the years and it's et cetera, et cetera, and now you understand why this bluish pill heals your problem, you don't have any faith anymore on that particular thing. You don't need faith for that. Now you understand because the body and blah, 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 I'm not a doctor. So you don't have anything more. Faith goes to a higher level, to things even now after learning so much, you still don't understand. So now faith applies to those things. But the truth is, just as we said before, and that's going to be like the trigger for the next part, so to speak, the truth is you don't have faith in the doctor. Not at all. Why? Because you only go to a doctor that you can see that he actually studied, and you can see the diploma, whatever, of the university, that he actually finished, and he approved all the exams, and he has experience, and if the sickness is a difficult one, you're not going to go to any doctor that just finished the university, you're going to go to somebody with experience, and so on. So where's the faith? There's no faith over here. It makes sense, if you have a problem with health, to go to a doctor. And the better the doctor can be, the best. The best medicine is going to give you, or whatever, the best solution is going to give you. So that's also a rational thing. It's not a faith thing. Would you go to a doctor that doesn't prove you, and there's no way you can really know that he actually studied? I would never go to such a doctor. I don't know. No way. And some people want to say, interesting, just as a way of joke, that when you go into a plane and you travel through whatever you want to travel, you never ask for the title, so to speak, the diploma of the pilot. People just go to the plane and they sit and they eat and they whatever, spend time. So why don't you ask who's the pilot and who's the, you know why? Very simple, because the pilot is also over there. And if you're going to die, he's going to die also. So he's playing his life in this whole thing. That's why you don't ask questions. I suppose he knows what he's doing. I just at least suppose, and that's also a rational thing after all. So what's faith? Let's go a little bit deeper into what faith means. Faith, again, doesn't apply to something you could understand, because anything you could understand at the end of the day is memale kolalmin, how God feels the world, how godly life is into things, and you can at some point grasp it, understand it to a certain point. Furthermore, even if you're going to say like the Abarbanel, we just read before, that God is the most complete existence, he doesn't depend on anything. Okay, I don't really understand what that means because I'm not a complete existence. I depend on other things to exist, at least on God to exist. However, even, as I said before, even intellect understands that there are things that are beyond intellect. But I understand it. I know that I don't know it. Such a thing exists. I don't know what it is. It's beyond me, but I know such a thing is possible, makes sense. Therefore, real faith, the real definition of faith, what does it mean? It's something that is completely beyond any definition you could ever give. It doesn't even make sense. It's a paradox. God is infinite and God is finite at the same time. It doesn't make sense. Yeah, I know. It doesn't make sense. But that's what God is. There's a philosopher, I don't remember the name, I think it was Russell, I don't know, and I don't like philosophy either, but he said, can God, like a stupid question, really stupid question. People think it's a very smart question, but it's a very stupid question. Can God create a stone that he cannot lift? If you're going to say God cannot create a stone he cannot lift, so he's not infinite, he's not all-powerful, almighty, he cannot create this stone. And if you're going to tell me he creates the stone and then he cannot lift it, he's not all powerful either. So God doesn't make sense. That's what the philosopher wants to say. Bye-bye, religion. Bye-bye, God. And the religious answer to this is, I'm sorry, Mr. Philosopher, you don't understand what God is. God can create a stone. he cannot lift and then lift it up. No, but it doesn't make sense. Yeah, that's what God is. That's faith. Doesn't make sense. Yeah, I know. That's faith. That's faith. One example of this, which is anyway not the best example, but it's an example of this. Avraham Avinu himself, we're going to learn later. Avraham Avinu, he almost killed his son. Almost. He didn't do it, and that's why there's a Jewish people, and that's why we're actually learning a class of Torah, because he didn't kill his son. But he was almost about to kill his son. Now, after almost killing his son, God said to him, now I know that you're a God-fearing person. Now I know. And our sages explain all the tests, all the challenges that that Abraham passed before were not enough. We're not even close to this challenge. Why not? Abraham had to give his own life for God. He threw himself into a fiery furnace, and he passed so many different tests. In all, there were 10 tests, and this was the last one. All the previous 9 were nothing against this one. Why? And the answer is, even when Abraham, at least the short answer, even when Abraham was giving out his own life for God, like we say, Gendik, that's it. It would have finished. Everything would have been finished. Even so, there were people looking. And people would have said, oh, you remember this guy Abraham? Yeah, poor guy. He got burned. But at least he was a honest guy. Yeah, he was a good guy. Honest guy. Whatever he believed on, I don't know what it was, but he was a good guy. Because there were people looking. At least somebody would say something about that, what he did. He passed away. He got burned. But at least people would have spoken about it. In this particular test, there was nobody looking. It was just Abraham and Yitzchak, his son. And his son was going to be dead. But nobody was looking over there. Nobody would know anything that happened. Yeah, you're saying you killed your son. He just left you. You're crazy. And your son just ran away and left you. Actually, Yitzchak was 37 years old. And Abraham was much older, like 137 years old. So you just, whatever, blow air on him. And Abraham falls and you run away. Your father is crazy. He's going to kill you. So nobody was looking. It was just Abraham and Yitzchak. And he still did it. Almost did it. So Hashem said to him, God said to him, now I understand. Now we're really a God-fearing person. Yeah, that's faith. What's the only problem with this example? God spoke to Abraham. God spoke to Abraham. Actually, the Alter Rebbe asks this question. If God would talk to me, I would do anything. Yes, definitely. But God didn't talk to me. And the Alter Rebbe asks, how many all around Jewish history, the history of the world, how many Jews died for God and God never spoke to them? Abraham was ready to give his life, but God spoke with him. That's, you know, something. You hear the word of God and so on. How many died and God didn't talk to them? And the answer that Rebbe gives is still Abraham's merit is very important. Why? Because he was the first. He was the first to do such a sacrifice. And therefore, he opened, so to speak, the channel of sacrifice for God in the world. So that's a merit. That's already something he did. But having said all of this, that's the real, so to speak, definition, Hasidic, deep definition of faith. When something makes no sense at all, and it not just doesn't make sense to you, because maybe you're a little bit stupid, so you don't understand, somebody else understands. No. Intrinsically, doesn't make sense. Essentially, doesn't make any sense. Oh, but you still go for that. Yeah, that's faith. Now, the question is, where does this come from? And is there any difference between the faith of a Jew and a non-Jew? What is brought down in Hasidic thought is that, yeah, there is a difference. Yes. And the difference is, non-Jews also have a soul, definitely. And it's brought down in different places. What's the soul of the non-Jew? How does it work? We're not going to discuss this now. But definitely, non-Jews have a soul. And the soul, one of the things that it does is to see, so to speak, godliness. There are different expressions of the soul. Some expressions are within the body, some expressions are outside the body. Whatever the details are, the point is that the soul sees godliness, just as the angels see godliness, and actually the soul of the non-Jews is pretty much related to the soul of the angels also. So when the non-Jew has faith, that faith has a cause, has a why, because their soul is looking at God at some point, at a certain point, like the angels. That's what's brought down in these particular places in Hasidus. And that means that that creates in the person a certain certainty that there is such a thing as godliness. Many people negate it, and many people live against it their whole life in conflict. And many people go and let it flow, and life is much easier and nicer. But the point is that that's the faith of a non-Jew. It's caused by the soul seeing God. In a Jew, there is also the same level. There's a level at which the soul is looking at God. There's a story by Daniel that was walking. I don't remember the number of the chapter. I can look it up. I forgot to write it down now in the presentation. But there's a story by Daniel. Daniel was walking with three friends actually. And at some point, Daniel sees a vision. And he gets very frightened by the vision. And his friends didn't see the vision. That's what Daniel says. They did not see, but they got frightened anyway. And the question is, the Talmud asks this question, Megillah. The Talmud asks, if they didn't see, why did they get afraid? Like Daniel saw, he was afraid. But the other ones didn't see. So why were they afraid? And the Talmud answers, they did not see, but the mazal, their soul, saw. And that had an effect in them, and that caused them to be afraid. That's what the Talmud answers. That means that there are certain spiritual things happening up there, whatever, let's call it up there, that we're not understanding what it is, we don't see it and so on, but still the soul sees it and it has an effect. The soul above sees it and it has an effect on the soul below, and we feel certain things. We don't know where they come from, but we feel it anyway. Same thing happens, exactly same thing happens, but we just get an idea of, I should do tshuva. Maybe I should repent myself. Maybe I should call the rabbi and ask him something. Where did that idea came from? Suddenly you were, whatever, watching a soccer game and I should be doing tshuva. Why? Okay, that's God calling the soul up there, and the soul up there has an effect on the soul down here, and suddenly you get an idea. In Hebrew it's called hirur tshuva, an imagination, yeah, I should be doing tshuva. I should be repenting myself or whatever, learning more Torah. I should be a better person, stop stealing. Yeah, maybe. These ideas come from God directly. And that's the source of the faith of the non-Jews. The Jew has another level of faith, a deeper level of faith that comes from the essence of the soul. But not that the soul is watching or seeing God. The soul is, so to speak, one with God. The essence of the soul of a Jew, that is not something that is understandable, is not something that is down here in the heart and so on. No. It's a very, very deep thing, and it only expresses itself in very, very critical situations. Like the Tanya explains, chapter 18, 19, there are certain situations in which, boom, the soul of the Jew just wakes up, and the Jew says, I can't do this. But you never cared about God. This, I can't. It's impossible. I'm sorry. This goes against who I am and what I am. So that's the faith, so to speak, of the Jew. That's where it comes from. And the difference between the faith of the Jew and the faith of the non-Jew. Now, having said all of this, a person should ask himself, what about the non-Jew? So what's about developing and making the faith of the non-Jew grow? How can I do this? And how can I actually access, so to speak, this part of the soul that is actually seeing God? So for that, I would like to read to you a few parts. It's kind of long. I'll try to do it as short as possible, so I'm not going to read every single word over here. But what I want to read to you is a Hasidic discourse by the previous Rebbe, He said this in 1941. And he's explaining Abraham. And the whole thing, it's like very long and complicated. I'm just going to read a part of the first chapter and a part of the second chapter. What is he talking about? We know in Parshas Vayera, Abraham planted an eishel. Va'ita eishel be'er sheva. That's what the pasuk said. The verse says he planted an eishel, some kind of a tree, in the city of Be'er Sheva. And our sages bring down in the Midrashim, and Rashi brings it down also, different explanations of what this eishel, what this tree actually was. And some say it was actually a hotel. And some say actually Abraham offered to every passerby food and drinks and fruits and meat and so on. And they ate, and when they were very happy. And when they finished eating, they said, "Thank you so much, Abraham. Very good food." And Abraham said, "Oh, wait a second. Don't thank me, thank God." And people used to, we're talking about Abraham, okay? Nobody spoke about God. That's what the Rambam says. We brought it before. So what do you mean, God? You gave me food, I'm thanking you. No. You have to thank God, the creator of the world. And when people started saying, "Nah, who's this God? We don't believe on this." Abraham said, "Okay, no problem. So you owe me this much for the meat, this much for the wine, this much for the fruit," like an enormous amount of money. And people said, "What? You're nuts. Yeah, in the middle of the desert, who's going to give you all of this?" So people said, "Okay, what do we have to say? Thank God that he's the creator of the world. Thank God, creator of the world," and move on. That's what Abraham used to do. And that's what the Midrash, our sages say. But the truth is, he didn't finish that. That's just the short version, so to speak, of the story. The story is much deeper. Abraham used to talk to these people while they were eating. And he was a very special type of guy, Abraham. He spoke, and he couldn't finish, stop speaking about God. What did he talk about? That's what we're going to learn. Abraham Abraham explained to these people godly things. And he explained with examples and with ideas that would be accepted, received, and understood by the human intellect of his visitors. We're talking about very ordinary people, very, very ordinary people that used to bow down actually to the idolatry of the dust under their legs, under their foot. So like very stupid people that Abraham used to talk to them and explain them. And he explained to them, what is this thing of godliness? Through different explanations that even the most simple people would understand. And those who did not understand, and this is the point, that's why I'm actually reading to you this text. For this line that comes right now, and at the end is going to come, the same idea. Why did he explain? Some people understood. Okay, some people were very smart people, and they understood what Abraham was explaining. But some people were so ordinary, they couldn't understand anything. And Abraham spoke to them hours, and just it doesn't go into their minds. So they, instead of understanding, they used to recognize, and they used to agree. Like moide, we see in the morning, every single morning, and this applies to non-Jews also, moide ani lefanecha. I recognize, it's not just thank you, God, for giving me back my soul. It's I recognize that you are the boss over here. Moide. So they used to agree and recognize to that which Abraham was saying. Why? Because such a love and such an enthusiasm Abraham had for God and for godliness, they couldn't just say anything against it. They just said, "Wow, this guy is on fire. Look how he talks about it. And he's really enjoying it." And then, so they used to say, "Yeah, you're right," because of the feeling. They used to feel the strength, the enthusiasm that Abraham had in what he was explaining. They used to say, "Yeah, you're right. Definitely right. There's nothing I can say about it. I don't understand what you're saying, but you're right. I see you're right. I feel you're right. I see and I feel that this is true." What did he explain? So Abraham explained that God is the creator of the world. Now, there's a whole long thing here. I'm going to make it very short. First thing that Abraham explained is the creation is something from nothing. And it's different than the creation of something from something. When a person does something out of, for instance, a piece of gold or a piece of ceramics or whatever, so the ceramics exist and you just give it a shape. And once you take out your hands from that, the shape remains in the ceramics. However, God, when he creates the world, since the creation is something from nothing, the nature of nothing is to be nothing. So as soon as God would take out his strength, his word, his creative power from the creation, the nature of creation is to be nothing. It would go back to be nothing. So God is constantly involved in the creation. This is the first thing that Abraham used to explain to them. In order for the whole creation to exist, God has to be involved in creating the whole creation. That's what it means, actually, a creation something or nothing. Yesh me'ain. Ex nihilo, we say in Latin or whatever. So that's the first thing that Abraham used to explain to them. And then he used to say what memale kol almin means, how God fills the worlds, because after all, each particular part of the creation, the stones, the plants, the animals, the human beings, each one needs a different amount and quality of godliness to exist and to maintain itself and to move on, to be sustained. And God measures to each creature the amount of life it needs, the amount of energy it needs. And furthermore, in order for the creation to exist, God conceals himself. He himself says, wait a second, if I'm going to take up, so to speak, all the space, and I'm going to be revealed everywhere, it's going to be impossible for anything else to exist. So I'm going to hide, conceal myself, to give, quote-unquote, room for something else to exist. This is the first subject Abraham used to explain to them. And this idea of creation, something from nothing, it only God can do that. As we said before, scientists, even until today, if they gather, the Talmud says, if all the scientists gather together, they can't create the feather, whatever they, I don't know how to say this, of a fly, whatever. They can't create a fly or anything else. They just can't give it life. Okay, this is the first thing. The second thing that Abraham used to explain to them is free will. Every single creature has free will, and that's something that God wants for the creature to choose between bad or good. Everything belongs to God because he creates everything. But however, he conceals against himself. Again, he conceals himself and gives free will to every single creature. So it's your choice whether you want to bless God or pay me. It's your choice after all. Not a problem. And the fact that God gives life to a person is to give the person the opportunity to actually do something in his world. Each one of us, it's an important creature in the world. That's why we exist. That's why you're alive. Actually, if you're listening to this, because you're alive. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening. So that means God is expecting something from you. God is expecting your service to him from you. Yeah, and what about the neighbor? I don't know. The neighbor has his own relationship with God and his own mission in life, so to speak. God is expecting something from you, particularly. And then he used to explain that God knows everything. And he is, so to speak, conscious of every single thing in the world, from the highest of the highest creatures to the lowest of the lowest creatures. And then he explained to the people intellectual ideas of how God relates to the world, and what does it mean to God, that God exists. And the Friedrich Rebbe, the previous Rebbe, brings quite a few ideas about this. I'm just going to jump to make it easier. But he says two very interesting things. For it, independently of how capable you are to understand intellectual things, there are two conditions that you need. Even if you're very smart, two conditions you need to understand very deep intellectual concepts. Condition number one, effort. You really have to put yourself into learning and learn more and deeper and so on. That's point number one. effort. And the second one is refinement of your brain. You have to refine your life in order to be able to understand more subtle and higher things. The more you are into the physical world, the less you're going to be able to understand higher and deeper concepts. The less you are into the physical world, then more refined you're going to be, and that's going to allow your brain to understand more refined things. And then he used to explain that God is not like a regular king of flesh and blood, because even though a regular king of flesh and blood gives everything to their to his subjects that are in the country and so on, and it's very important what the king gives you and so on, but it just gives you things that support your life. Once you're alive, so the king gives you. The king gives you laws. The king gives you a framework to function, a country. The king gives you money or whatever you need. That's what the king is. However, God gives you life. Not just what you need to live. Gives you life itself. And after all these explanations for hours, they recognized, this is going back to the first ideas that I brought down, they recognized and they agreed and they praised God and they blessed God that he spoke and created the world. And independently up to what level of understanding they actually reached. And this is what actually the reason why God loved so much Abraham, because he publicized all over the world the existence of God and the deepest concepts that are actually explained in Hasidus about God. Now, having said all of this, let's go back and imagine just for a second. Who was Abraham talking to? He wasn't talking to Jews. Abraham was not a Jew either. No, he was talking to non-Jews. And not just regular non-Jews. As I explained before, non-Jews, people that used to bow down to dust. That they thought God is dust. That's how intellectually deep they were. And still Abraham used to sit down and explain to them all these ideas in deep, with deep examples, with a lot of patience and so on. And that's exactly what it means when there's one verse in the Psalms, I forgot the number right now, but it says, Re'ei Emuna. We're supposed to nurture the faith. As I explained before, faith is something we have to move up and nurture constantly. How? By understanding who God is, by learning about him, and that makes our power of faith each time in a higher and higher level. And that depends on us. You could live in a very simple and basic level of faith, and whatever, you have faith that God exists. Okay. I can't say that's wrong. There are certain authorities that actually hold like that, but it's a very basic thing. Very basic and very start the path thing. You have to start learning. And the more you learn, the more you refine yourself, the more effort you put into it, the more you're going to be able to understand. And then you're going to nurture your own faith up until you reach your highest level. And the truth is that, again, this idea of the highest level of faith, even though we say it applies to Jews because the essence of the soul and blah, 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 very nice. But the fact that we can actually learn about certain ideas at least opens our minds for the Jews and for the non-Jews that to the idea that there's something else. There's something more. And there's something completely impossible to understand. Not that I don't understand. Nobody understands. And that's the essence of godliness. And that's what actually means the coming of Moshiach. Moshiach is not coming just for the Jews. Moshiach is coming to reveal in the world the presence of God in a way that everybody will see this. That's why I thought, just to finish, I put this Psalm 67. It's a short one. I'm not going to read the whole thing. You can read and you can look up in your books, Psalm 67. But there are a few verses, very interesting and short. The Psalm itself is talking about, is talking on the days, about the days of Mashiach. And the Psalm says, peoples will praise you, God. Peoples will praise you, nations will exalt and shout for you. That means everybody's going to understand and perceive whatever is going to happen, whatever, I don't know, but they're going to perceive, everybody's going to perceive godliness. To the point that not just the Jewish people will praise God. Peoples will praise God, nations will praise God, whatever the difference is between peoples and nations. And that's what Mashiach means. And that's what we're supposed to be doing right now. Preparing ourselves by learning, through learning about God, through learning these deep concepts with one example, another example, and more and more and more, in order to make this world a dwelling place for God, in order to make ourselves a dwelling place for God, and that's going to cause, so to speak, the revelation of Mashiach speedily in our days.